Hi there and welcome. Jonathan here. These talks are offered freely so that no one is ever denied access to these practices. Your support makes a big difference. If you feel inspired to make a donation, please go to jonathanfaust.com. Thank you. Whenever I have a Dharma talk, oftentimes on a particular topic, life will present some kind of experience or it'll trigger some deep memory for myself. I had mentioned earlier that for a number of years, while I was going to college and grad school out in the Midwest, I was co-managing a 1,000-acre farm and in charge of 500 hogs. And at that time, to complete the picture, I had a 1963 Chevy Fleetside pickup truck with three on the tree. How many people know what three on the tree? Yeah, oh, good, good. It's the shifters on the column, a three-speed. And my truck only had an AM radio. So I started listening to country music because that's all there was. So I would listen to WMAQ out of Chicago. And country music is so interesting. You can sing along to it. It's, you know, like I can see why it's engaging. But there's one song that kind of I was remembered in meditation that it speaks of one's métier, you know, one's purpose in life, of your professional expression no longer being in alignment with your higher purpose. It's a song by Johnny Paycheck. It's a timeless hit. You probably know it. It's called Take This Job and Shove It. I'll read you the chorus. I'll spare you the song. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. My woman done left and took all the reasons I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way because I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. So tonight's topic is Right Livelihood. I thought that was the perfect song for it. We've been exploring the path as the Buddha spoke of what it means to be awake in the world. He described four essential principles. The first is that when you come into human form, suffering happens. Suffering is part of life. Stress, dissatisfaction, unsteadiness. The second truth or the second insight is there's a cause for your stress or dissatisfaction or suffering. And the source of that has to do with attachment and clinging. The third principle or insight or truth is that it's possible to let go. Whatever you're holding on to, whatever you're identified with, whatever you're clinging on to, it is possible to let it go and experience freedom where you did not feel it before. And the fourth insight is that there is a path. There are technologies, there are applications, there are guidelines, there are observances and restraints that will support you in your life of letting go where you're holding on and finding more and more freedom. So he outlined these guidelines for ethical living. And these are the guidelines we've been exploring. And when you go on a retreat, you make a formal commitment to these guidelines to support you in your practice. And they become wonderful riverbanks in life as well. And they have to do first with not killing, not taking life heedlessly, not stealing, and taking only what is freely given, and not misusing sex, not lying, and abstaining from intoxicants and other poisons that cloud the mind and cloud consciousness. So ethical livelihood is basically how do you find a way to provide for yourself and for your family and others without engaging into those activities. But like all things that have to do with ethics, it's deeply nuanced. It's not kind of a fundamentalist black or white. And it can be very, very helpful to reflect on your work and how much it aligns with those principles. It's really about finding your highest expression in life. So what I'd like to talk about tonight first has to do with the question of what is true, just the importance of really looking at your work with real honesty. The second question is, can you be with it? You know, is how you are living your life in alignment? Does it require any change or any alteration, either externally or internally? The third is to explore a little bit about what the Buddha taught about right livelihood. And the fourth thing I'd like to talk about is what it's like to live through the lens of service when you see your work as a way to serve. A number of years ago, I was working with someone who had a pretty high-paying job. And he worked in the defense industry as a consultant. Really, really smart person. And he worked with mathematical models that were enhancing satellite communications and finding a way to like exponentially tweak communications. And this work, like a lot of military research, it did have great implications in the long run for civilian use, but in the meantime, it was about speeding up communications on the battlefield and in military preparedness. And he was very deep into the practice, and I remember him saying, he said, someday I'm going to have to let this go. You know, I'm not ready yet, but someday I can feel like it's going to be time to let this job go. In the meantime, he enjoyed the intellectual stimulation and the stability and the high income. And a few years later, as I was talking with him, he said, I'm done. So I don't want to go forward in my life this way. It just no longer feels right for me. And fortunately, because of his high skill, he was able to use his mathematical genius in a different way in a civilian area. But it's an important thing to really reflect when you think about how many hours you spend working or how many hours you spend engaged in activity. To really ask yourself, is this in alignment? So I thought I might offer just a short inquiry, just a short reflection. If you like, you can close your eyes. And it's really just to explore a question. One of the things I like about the practice of inquiry is you hear a question, you let yourself respond. And then I'll just repeat the question a little bit. When you think of your work in the world, what's one thing that's between you and feeling happy with your work? You just might name one thing and just kind of say hello to that. And again, as you think of work, what's one thing that comes to mind that's between you and feeling really happy? question in again. Just one thing that's between you and feeling really happy in your work. Saying hello to that. And then one more time. Just one thing that's between you and feeling happy with your work. And then if you'd like, you can deepen your breath. And just saying hello to whatever kind of came up for you. You can let your eyes open. I like that question. I like that inquiry. Because sometimes it will just sort of like bring to mind just some little small little niggly thing that just needs a little more attention. Sometimes our relationship to work is sort of like small. It's an internal attitude. Sometimes our relationship to work is much broader. The question becomes, how can you find a way of your personal expression that feels most in alignment for yourself? Something Thich Nhat Hanh said, to practice right livelihood, you have to find a way to earn your living without transgressing your ideals of love and compassion. The way you support yourself can be an expression of your deepest self, or it can be a source of suffering for you and for others. Your vocation can nourish your understanding and compassion or erode them. We should be aware of the consequences, far and near, of the way we earn our living. So this question can get quite nuanced. I heard a story of someone who loved the work she was doing, kind of as a copy editor in a kind of a rather large firm. But then she understood that the business she was in was highly unethical in relating to the government and to other companies. And she realized that she didn't want to participate in that. At the same time, everything we do ultimately creates some form of conflict or some form of harm. I just got back from teaching in New England. Tara and I were leading two separate retreats up in New England. And beautiful retreats, you know, wonderful connections, wonderful insights. But we flew up in a jet, used a lot of resources. We weren't exactly carbon neutral in that. So there's a certain question there. Is this really an ethical thing to do, to be jet-setting around teaching? I don't have the answer to that, but it's helpful to look at the subtlety of it all. So it's important to ask ourselves, is my work satisfying? Is my work in alignment with my ideals? And then the next question is, can I be with it? Does this require a change? I have a number of conversations with people who are not happy with their work. There's always the question of, should I stay or should I go? And I was once in dialogue with someone who really hated her job. She had a boss who was just nasty. And it was a really toxic situation. Her whole department was unhappy. Her boss ruled by fear and intimidation. So her question was, should I leave this or should I go? And so we took some time to slow down and look at the underpinnings of her attitude. And as she described her past and how it was showing up in the present, she had a very dominating mother. She had a dominating older brother. And her strategy in life was to go along in order to get along. And she realized that for her, if she left this job, she would probably end up in exactly the same situation again, of being dominated and abused by someone and putting up with it in order to survive. So as we explored this, she started to craft a way that she could start to speak up and actually make a stand for herself. And she realized that if she were to stand up to this dominating boss, it could mean the end of her job anyway. But for her, she realized that this was a growth opportunity. So she went for it. She took it on. She started to speak up. She found lots of support to kind of help her in challenging her boss and trying to speak the truth for the whole department that was really upset. And it turns out that her boss, who absolutely was a dominating personality, really liked having someone she could spar with. And her boss ended up really enjoying her new outspokenness and became an ally for her in the organization and was actually able to hear what she had to say, and the entire environment improved. So for her, just stepping out would have been kind of a premature decision. But by rather than changing the externals, but focusing on the internals, she was not only able to transform herself, but transform her whole work environment, which was a very inspiring process. It really very much changed her life. So another short reflection, a little Zen pop quiz for you. If you like, you can close your eyes. When you think of your work, and again, if you're not working, just the ways that you're showing up, the ways that you're serving, what are the challenges? What would you say are the three biggest challenges for you right now? What are the lessons, the opportunities for you in how you show up at work or in relationship with others? What would you say are your greatest opportunities for growth or transformation? And if you like, you can deepen your breath and let your eyes open. Our work can become a fascinating mirror. It becomes a mirror of our attitudes and how we show up in the world. And we all tend to fear change. And many of us get stuck because of that fear of change. Breaking out of a mold in our habits, in our relationships with work, can be incredibly challenging. There's an interesting model I've found very, very helpful. And it's really kind of a model of how we evolve through life, but also a very interesting way to see how this model applies and how we show up in our work. On the very first level, this is articulated by a guy named John Keegan. The very first level is what we call the opportunist. So you're looking through this lens of it's all about personal wins. You see something, you grab it because someone else might take it. So it's kind of a very, very tightly focused, kind of narcissistic approach to life. The second is referred to as the diplomat. And in here, you exchange your personal freedom in order to belong. So here you will tolerate a job because it pays your bills. And on this stage, you kind of go with the flow. You don't really make waves. You get your check, and you stay low, and you go home. many, many people kind of operate on this level. So you've got a profession or a job. It's not that satisfying, but it's enough. The next level is called the expert or the achiever. And here you're kind of at the top of your game. You know, you're a pro, you're respected, you can make it happen. But at the same time, you're still part of a tribe. And what that leads to is this next level called the individualist. And this is kind of an awakening process where you ask yourself, wait a minute, what am I doing? Whose life am I living out here? Am I just living out the life that my primary caretaker set up for me, living out their expectations? What do I want? What do I need? And this sets you up for kind of your 40 days and nights in the desert to really answer that question. When you answer that question, it can lead you to what's called the strategist, where you are doing what you love and you're contributing at a very high level. You're deeply in relationship with others. You have a capacity to collaborate, to hear other people's attention, other people's intentions and their vision, and work toward a greater collective whole. And the next level is called the alchemist or the magician, where you see the big picture and you become an agent of change for that large kind of global change out there. I found that model to be very, very helpful for myself. When I look back, I see at different times I was kind of living in each one of those stages. The time when we really stop and say, wait a minute, is what I'm doing in alignment with my values? If I look back and want to live a life of no regret, is what I'm doing in alignment with that? That's a very brave question and a very powerful question. So when it comes to right livelihood, there's no clean answer here. It has to resonate for you. Many, many years ago, probably 5 years ago, I was leading a meditation retreat. And there was a young woman with her husband who was, they were attending this retreat. They had just gotten married a little while ago, and I believe he was a lieutenant in the Army. I met with them, and he was on leave after his first tour in Afghanistan. And they thought that a meditation retreat would be just what he needed to learn some skills, because he was going right back in for his second tour. And as I talked with this guy, I was so moved by his very, very pure intent. He was very, very excited about the possibility of rebuilding this country. He had gone to school and learned the local languages. He was working very, very hard to bring different factions together to communicate. And he was very lit up about his life. And actually very excited to go back, because he could see how he was making a difference in that culture. And I realized how much prejudice I had, you know, toward, you know, the armed forces in general. And getting this guy's wholesome desire to make a difference in the world pretty radically shifted my concept of what we were doing over there. So it's easy to make things black or white. But as the Buddha said, finding your dharma is your dharma. Finding your path is your path. He said, your task is to explore what your work is and then give yourself to it fully. So another short little inquiry, little 1 minute reflection. When you think of your expression in the world, what do you love? What lights you up? If you were assured of success, no matter what you chose to do, what would you choose? If you knew no one would judge you, what would you do? So when you're ready, you can deepen your breath, and if you like, you can open your eyes. I used to lead a workshop where I would have people get out a sheet of paper. On one column, you write down everything you enjoy, everything that gives you pleasure. On the other column, you'd write down any way you could make money doing what you love and what gives you pleasure. You just brainstorm. I always tell people, write down food and sex first. Get it out of the way. But it's a very interesting question. When you kind of break the mold, you know, what lights you up? What would you enjoy? Ken Wilber, when he wrote his first book, he chose his job as washing dishes in a restaurant, because it gave him the freedom to kind of think through what he was writing. I know some people in my life who have consciously chosen kind of a non-challenging job where they just got the paycheck so they could give all of their time and attention to their family, to their young family. They did not want a job that was going to take them away from the family. On the other hand, there's a wonderful book by Joe Dominguez called Your Money or Your Life, where you do a whole assessment of what he calls your life energy units, where you take your income, but then you include the amount of money you spend on your uniform, the time you spend commuting, the time you spend being sick because of stress, the time you spend thinking about your job, and then you kind of work out this equation and then figure out what your real hourly is. It could be quite stunning when you think about it. But his strategy is find the highest paying job that's according to your skill set, live as simply as you can, save all the money you need so you know you can survive, and then get the heck out of Dodge. That's his advice. And then there are entrepreneurs who just love building things. And the money is kind of a way of keeping score, but there's so much enjoyment in that building. So finding your path is your path. And we then tend to think of work as what we do to provide for ourselves, as what we do to provide for our families. But generally, it's very much about what's in it for me. And it can be very helpful to explore what it's like to translate work as service. When you sort of substitute the word service for work. I think because of my lifestyle of living on farms and living in ashrams, I very rarely have I gone to any popular concerts, but I did go to one in Albuquerque, New Mexico, many, many years ago, when I got my first job out of grad school. I was teaching, and it was a Bob Dylan concert when he was in his Christian phase. And you may know his song, You Gotta Serve Somebody. I'll read you another chorus here. I don't know why songs are a theme here. Well, the chorus says, but you're going to have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed. You're going to have to serve somebody. It may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody. Another short reflection, if you would. You can close your eyes. When you reflect on your current work or how you're serving right now, when you consider what it's like to substitute the word work for service, what does that feel like when you think of your job as serving others? If you think of your role as a mother or father or son or daughter or sibling through this lens of service, what does that feel like? If you'd like, you can deepen the breath and let the eyes open. The great teacher Ram Dass wrote a book a number of years ago, and the title is How Can I Help? Which is about what happens when you take on the role of server. You may be familiar with the word bodhisattva. And a bodhisattva is someone who lives to serve, who holds herself back from liberation in order to help others, and whose life is transformed through serving others. When we begin to live our lives through that lens of how can I help, it can dramatically change the equation in our lives from what's in it for me to how can I be of service. It's certainly not uncommon for this question of right livelihood to be a burning question. How do you make your best use of your time on this planet? There's a wonderful phrase that says, bloom where you're planted. How can you make a difference right where you are? How could you transform where you work right now? Those who you know around you who are struggling, how could you make a difference in their lives through some attention or care? I was at the nursing home visiting my father just before he passed, and I was visiting with one of the aides. She had had a pretty rough upbringing in her life, and her work was really hard on her body. She was, you know, lifting people and bathing them, tending to their needs, trying to make them as comfortable as she could. And she was pretty worn out. But as we were just talking about life in general, she said, my body hurts, but I'm so grateful to have found the work I'm here to do on this planet. This is my calling. I was so touched by the purity of her heart. The form of her work was making the elderly as comfortable as possible and letting them know that someone cared. But the essence of her work was about serving. So our work can be a way of making sure we're safe, making sure those that we love are safe. But it can be interesting to look at the different stages of life as are described by the Vedas, that the first stage of your life is about being a good child. Then you go through the next phase of life of being a good student, you know, learning about life, developing skills. The next stage of your life is about being a good provider, kind of fulfilling your duties as a provider. And then what the Vedas say, as soon as that's done, as soon as you have done enough to provide for yourself and for others, then the rest of your life is devoted to service and to awakening, which are really kind of the same thing. It's devoting yourself to full realization of who you really are and about cultivating wisdom and cultivating compassion. So ultimately, I think that's perhaps what our work is all about. Oftentimes it comes from a place of a self-doing. But when the Buddha said, nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I or mine, it changes our relationship to work. Because it's not so much about collecting and gathering as it is about being fully awake and fully alive and fully realized. So with that, why don't we close with a short meditation, short reflection. You might let your attention just come in to embrace this breath and these sounds, this quality of feeling. And perhaps taking these moments to reflect on this mystery of being alive in this body right here. And this breath. This life you have been given. You might imagine at the end of this life, as you look back, what was most important to you? What do you most value? We'll close with this short poem from Wendell Berry. I'll read it twice. It's that short. It's entitled The Real Work. It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work. And that when we no longer know which way to go, we have come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work. And that when we no longer know which way to go, we have come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. In these final moments, just reflecting on this mystery and that which calls you forward. And as you're ready, you can deepen the breath. And when you're ready, you can let your eyes open. And thank you for your time and attention. This right livelihood thing is kind of gnarly. A few announcements. If you'd like to be on the mailing list, you can sign up in the back. Thank you as always for your support for the church and me and my lavish lifestyle. Also, I want to let you know that April 30th, I'm going to be offering a day-long retreat, and it's called the Inquiry Intensive, exploring the questions that can set you free. Inquiry as a way of helping you reframe your life to solve problems and how to turn your attention toward non-conceptual awareness. And I'm looking forward to the day, and it's going to be here in this room. So I'm grateful to the church for making this available, and I'll send more information out, but it's going to be, it's a very, very juicy day long. I think you'll enjoy it. So to fuel you in your journey, we have tea and cookies waiting for you. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful, wonderful week.